You know, I think probably that the best way to start, I don't know if you've ever looked at our statute, but it of course lists out all these items about, look at these various things in terms of causes of the financial crisis. And given your background and everything you've looked at over time, I think it might make sense to just go through those topics and get your thoughts on them. I suspect that you may have more thoughts on other topics than certain ones, given your background when it comes to regulation and mortgage fraud and that kind of stuff. But would that be an agreeable way to start?
I am of service to you in any way you consider it to be of service.
Great. And then we've been taping all interviews. Does that present any problems for you?
I hereby consent.
Thank you very much, sir.
And using them,
okay.
Disseminating them, if you wish.
Okay, so let's do this. Bill, what we've been doing with folks, even though I know your background since you used to be my boss, we've been asking folks to just summarize their educational and work background from college forward. So can you do that so we have it for the record, and then we'll jump into the substance?
Undergraduate, University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, economics. Law school, University of Michigan. Graduate school, PhD in criminology, law, and society at University of California at Irvine. You want dates?
You got them.
73, 76, and 86, probably. Jobs. I started with Squire Sanders and Dempsey in their Washington office. In May 1976, I went to the Justice Department, Civil Division, Federal Programs Branch in 1980 through 1981, returned to Squire Sanders and Dempsey, joined the Federal Home Loan Bank Board as litigation director on April 2nd, 1984, became deputy director of FISLIC, for program development and implementation in January of 1987. Now we have the complicated one where I'm two things at once because I'm detailed. I become general counsel and SVP of the Federal Home Loan Bank of San Francisco roughly April 1987, but I am detailed to continue serving as deputy director of FISLIC through the end of June 1987. At that point, I become resident in San Francisco. I remain SVP and general counsel until the creation of the Office of Thrift Supervision. And my title for most of that period was Senior Deputy Chief Counsel for Enforcement and Litigation West Region. Runs trippingly off the tongue. I was then detailed again to the National Commission on Financial Institution Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement, the inevitable National Commission to study the causes of the savings and loan debacle. In late 92 through 93, and I left OTS in 1994 to go to the University of California at Irvine, and that refreshes my recollection that my PhD was actually granted in 1998. I began, however, as an assistant professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin when I was ABD in fall of 1996. I had various stints at Santa Clara University and its business school, its law school, and its Markela Center for Applied Ethics, and I joined the University of Missouri, Kansas City roughly 4 years ago. It's a little confusing because we split semesters so that our youngest child could graduate from his high school. And my primary appointment is in economics. I have a joint appointment in law. That's my background.
Thank you, Bill. Okay, you know, like I said, you know, we have this statute with all these subsections that say look at these as potential causes or contributing causes to the financial crisis. Before I start listing them and asking you your opinion, let me just ask the broad-based question to get your views on it. What do you feel are the major causes, primary causes to the financial crisis?
Well, I think the primary cause of the crisis, the reason the bubble hyperinflated and led to the Great Recession, is what the FBI aptly called the epidemic of mortgage fraud in their September 2004 testimony. What are you folks' background? I know yours.
Right, you know mine.
Am I talking to economists? Or am I talking to lawyers or all of the above?
You're talking to, obviously, me as a lawyer and somewhat of a financial analyst and a journal.
I'm Stephen Mintz. I'm a financial writer.
And I'm Mike Easterly. I have a PhD from a joint program in history and economics.
Okay. So if you think about it as essentially right-shifting the demand curve, very substantially. If you look at the Credit Suisse numbers, and I'll be interested in what you folks find, because I don't think the numbers are terribly reliable on the percentage of stated income loans, but Credit Suisse in their fall 2006 report claims that stated income had become 50% of all new mortgage originations. You folks have a better number working internally?
If we do, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, we have a separate sort of numbers geek kind of department that we deal with, but their research is ongoing.
Yeah, so we have a lot of numbers that breaking it out risk layers by various ways. I don't know on that specific risk layer what they're saying in terms of what the percentage of originations were.
You're breaking up pretty badly. I don't know how close to the mic you may need to be to get across to effectively. But I heard, I think, the key things. What you have here, of course, is really widespread failure to report stated income. We know from looking at Lehman, we know from Fannie and Freddie, that they were not reporting accurately stated income. And so it's going to be a very big challenge for you folks to come up with the right number. Whatever the number is, it appears to be a very large number, such that essentially the marginal mortgage became the liar's loan. And you are talking about volumes that can actually move markets and cause the bubble to last years longer and become much greater. And as you know, losses are not likely to be linear in these circumstances. If you grow the bubble another 40%, you could get much greater losses than the 40%, or you could get smaller losses. I think you're going to see larger losses. And if you look at, the difficulty we have is that regulation took a holiday for about 10 years. So, again, I'll be interested if you have better numbers, but I prompted the Huffington Post reporter to keep bird-dogging the regulatory agencies. And the answer they gave him is that OTS and OCC have done zero criminal referrals. Now, is that really true? Do you guys know?
I don't know, but I know the numbers are down substantially. I don't know if they're down to zero.
I mean, that's not down substantially. We're talking about going from thousands to zero, if that's true, or something that closely approximates zero, which when you're facing an epidemic, is zero.
Right.
And I can tell you the reporter's comment as well was in talking to the OCC and OTS folks, them going, I mean, what a weird question. Why would we do criminal referrals? It's like, well, I don't know. Maybe because you were trying to be regulators. So the metaphor that I use is that we're the Sherpas as regulators. We have to do the heavy lifting, and we have to serve as a guide function. And Chris, you certainly know what a criminal referral from our era looked like. So these are frequently 20 to 30 page documents with 100, sometimes 300 pages of attachments. And if you take an, I mean, I trained FBI agents and AUSAs and Treasury agents to try to investigate and bring these cases. You can't take an FBI agent, including, and I mean a white collar specialist, and just dump them into WAMU and say, go make a case. You know, it's not going to happen. And again, they'll make some cases. But without the regulators, they were completely lost. And unfortunately, the terrible, terrible thing that happened is, and I'm using their word, the FBI formed a partnership with the Mortgage Bankers Association. Now, that's the trade association of the PERPs. And the Mortgage Bankers Association came out with that utterly stupid, all fraud is divided into two parts, unlike Gaul, which has three parts. And these two parts, it just so happens that in neither of them is the CEO ever at fault. Right? It's never, they're always the victim of these. Now, that makes no sense in terms of history. That means we have hundreds of years of history of what causes the largest bank failures, and it is overwhelmingly fraud. So that's the largest driver. If you look at other things that went on, was leverage important? Absolutely. Leverage is one of the ways that you optimize fraud, right? You've been exposed to my four-part recipe, but here it is again. You grow like crazy. You make really, really bad loans at premium yield, and those two are related. In a reasonably competitive, mature market, you can't simply decide to grow rapidly by making high-quality loans. If you wanted to do that, you'd have to buy market share. You'd have to slash yield in a reasonably competitive marketplace, and housing is, housing finance is. Your competitors would react, and at the end of the day, you'd get some first mover, you know, uptick. Maybe you'd grow 6% a year. But you'd slash your yields, and you would, and your competitors would, dramatically reduce their stated income as opposed to the other way around. So that's why you grow rapidly by making bad loans. And again, this is something not weird. This is Akerlof and Romer, and this is Pierce, UC Berkeley economist in studying the savings loan crisis, who says this explicitly, as did a number of the other folks, and of course I say it as well. Third element is extreme leverage, and the fourth element is trivial loss reserves. So how would this play out? Unlike the fallacy of composition, is fallacy of composition a familiar concept?
Explain it, please.
So fallacy of composition is a strategy that can work for one party or a few parties, but it can't work for an entire group. Right? So growing out of your problems as a whole industry doesn't work. Several institutions could do it. And this is fairly common in finance. It's allegedly the reason for Black Monday and such, when the program trading, you know, basically a lot of people program the same trade in response to the same events. If all of us try to sell at the same time, markets drop precipitously. That's fallacy of composition. Mm-hmm. It works the opposite when you have widespread accounting control fraud. Because what happens is, think of 500 of us doing this, and that's a fairly realistic number. And we're growing very rapidly. We're shifting, as I said, we're right shifting the demand curve. What happens to price? Price goes up. Price goes up the more you glut the market. Right? The composition works the other direction, and that is really good, because the obvious problem with the fraud recipe is the second part, making the bad loans. They are going to blow up. Now, that's the reason for Akerlof and Romer's title, and of course, titled my book as well, but their title,
looting.
To cut through the unnecessary words, looting bankruptcy for profit. The entity will fail, but with modern compensation, the people will walk away very rich. But it can fail very rapidly when you make liar's loans. But it won't if you're doing so in a bubble, and if you can hyperinflate and extend the life of that bubble. Now, this is, you don't need to conspire. This is not, you know, some big get-together. And again, Akerlof and Romer in their 1993 piece point this out. People will emulate this behavior because you'll see the bonuses. And in the, and since 1993, the Gresham's dynamic is much more powerful. Right? The average CFO in America's tenure is around 3 years. Now, that's a big problem in itself. Right? It's vain to talk about you should have long-term perspectives when people have tenures of that nature. But you rightly fear as a CFO that your tenure is going to be one quarter if you don't emulate the practices that others have that are producing these spectacular earnings. Because then it isn't just you that doesn't get the bonus. It's all your peers that don't get your bonus. And more importantly, it's the CEO, and in the modern era, often the chairman, the board as well, may have bonus features. And so you fear being gone. So the composition works the opposite direction. It's an odd use of the word, but it's a virtuous cycle in the sense that it's self-sustaining for a time. It's obviously in a real rhetorical sense the opposite of virtuous. What would we expect to see out of that kind of world? We would expect loan quality to get progressively much worse. I think that's what you're seeing. We would expect the spread to fall. I think that's what you're seeing as well. And that doesn't make any sense in a neoclassical world. Right? Assuming that you have a neoclassical world that excludes Akerlof and Romer. And that's kind of the world we live in, even though it makes no sense. What else would you expect to see? Well, if I really turn my loss reserves into trivial amounts, especially as the spread is falling, I maintain greater profitability. And you can see from the reports that that's exactly what happened. The loss reserves, as asset quality is becoming disastrous. I mean, beyond disastrous, right? It's deteriorating every week. As losses are growing, as delinquencies are growing, as fraud, reported fraud, is growing, loss reserves fall. And they fall every year. And they fall to record lows not seen since the savings and loan crisis. And but we're talking about loan quality that is an order of magnitude worse than the savings and loan crisis. When you're talking about liar's loans, the incidence of fraud is extraordinary. And it isn't just fraud about income. Remember that appraisal fraud becomes endemic as well. And that there are really good numbers on this. And that, again, is another aspect of aggression's dynamic. So we have the studies. Cuomo did them in the context of WAMU. And WAMU had a real honest-to-God blacklist. But you got on the blacklist as an appraiser if you were honest. What we stress is, in the criminology biz and the regulatory biz, you get an industry that is effectively displaying endemic fraud long before you get even a substantial minority of the profession willing to engage in fraud. In other words, if I get 5% of the appraisers willing to give me the numbers, that's all I need. And, I mean, it's really compelling. Over 10% of all the appraisers in the United States signed a petition asking the government to clean up this disaster. 90% of them report attempts at coercion in a given year. 60% of them report that they lost business or were not paid because they refused to inflate. When you put those things together, the underlying fraud about income and the appraisal fraud, then you get really disproportionate losses. And you spread those through the system. How do you spread those through the system? Well, this is another thing we emphasize. You don't, again, need any great conspiracy. I'm Aurora, Lehman's Liar's Loan outfit, right? Aurora didn't originate virtually anything. It purchased it. Well, if I pay a very high commission and I pay a bigger commission for higher yield product and I don't look at quality, I mean, what do we not, I mean, we all understand what this dynamic results in, right? They understood what that dynamic resulted in. When they looked themselves, just like when WAMU looked themselves, just like when New Century looked themselves, whenever their internal audit, Citicorp, in its testimony to you folks about the percentage non-conforming, every time we have anybody that looked or we have a written record, it's not like it's a little bit wrong. It's 50, 70, 80, 90% non-compliance. Aurora fires its risk review guy because he makes a criminal referral. Says it violates their privacy policy. So, again, if you don't look, if you don't investigate, and we, the modern regulators overwhelmingly did not investigate, you're not going to find very much. They assumed away the idea that you could have fraud coming from the top. If you don't, then you can't possibly think my job isn't to make criminal referrals, because nobody thinks that a savings and loan is going to make a criminal referral on a CEO when he's still in charge, right? I mean, no one's that crazed in a regulatory rank. So they had to exclude even that possibility that that type of thing could happen, even though, I mean, we just come out of Enron, WorldCom. Anybody doubt that those are frauds, or that they're run from the top, or that they were seemingly legitimate elite institutions? And how did they do it? They did it through the compensation system. Nobody had to have a great discussion. And who aided them? Have you looked at the bankruptcy examiner report? On Enron, by any chance?
Oh, on Enron, no. I thought you meant Lehman.
It's all the top banks. And all of them knew that Fastow was self-dealing. And all of them knew. Of course, this is really important because it's the antecedent of the SIVs. This is the SPVs. They're the same thing. And you know how much grief they took about the absurdity of 3%?
Right.
Right? That's a familiar concept to everybody, the 3%. Well, Enron never made 3%. Not a single time, as far as we can find out. In each case, it gamed it. And it gamed it, some cases, by bringing in cronies of Fastow, but primarily by bringing in banks. And it negotiated, Fastow negotiated agreements with them that said, you're not really providing capital. Or loans, you know, the old stuff, Chris, of the letter in the drawer.
Right.
Except in the case where they agreed once not to have the letter in the drawer and to make it oral because they didn't want the letter to be in the drawer.
Right.
And people looked. And as far as we can tell, all the banks said yes. And that resulted not in any criminal cases, but in enormous civil liability. measured in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So they all, you know, made the cases go away. But that's the antecedent to this. So it's truly bizarre that people stopped thinking that fraud could be important. Especially, as I say, it wasn't just the FBI. Other industry types started, actually, 2003 was the first use that I found of the epidemic of mortgage fraud in the press. And they talk about the same phrase, epidemic of accounting fraud, in 2005, I believe it is. I put it in the reference, mm-hmm. one of my papers. So a lot of the things we see are certainly important. So what would have happened had there been no secondary market? Would they have choked more quickly? Absolutely. Right? Mortgage bankers would have always loved to have done this. As you know, the sales could not happen under neoclassical theory. Right? So you get a lot of folks saying, well, you know, nobody cared because they just sold the stuff. But neoclassical economics says you're not supposed to be able to sell crap. Right? You're not supposed to be able to sell toxic stuff. And this stuff was, well, first it was literally, that was the phrase used in the trade, and it had been used in the trade for 20 plus years, describing this stuff as toxic. We had killed it in 1990, 1991. Liar's loans started becoming material then. And we just stopped it by supervision. We didn't even think it was a big deal because it was so obviously insane. So, you know, what kind of markers do you look for? Adverse selection is a really big marker. Now, adverse selection can work in really small loans done in really big volume where you can cut off people. In other words, credit cards. But it doesn't work really well even there, right? It creates a lemons market, in essence. It doesn't work for really big loans, and everybody knows it. Adverse selection creates a negative expected value. And again, you can't assume you're going to be able to sell the stuff under neoclassical theory because people should be looking under neoclassical theory. That's what private market discipline is supposed to be all about. And this stuff long predates Fannie and Freddie. Right? The key was getting the rating agencies. Now, how do you get the rating agencies to take stuff that isn't even single C and give it a triple A? Well, you do it in the same way you do all the other professionals. How is it that you're able to get consistently clean opinions from top-tier audit firms? Why do they always go to top-tier audit firms first?
They've got the rep.
Exactly. The reputation is valuable. They are your most valuable ally. And who is the most like an auditor in terms of adding their rep? The rating agencies. How did they do it? The same way. And the internal documents of Moody's show this. Right? They say, we tried to hold the line on the mezzanine tier. Now, note that that is a much smaller tier where the big bucks worked. And it says, we you can get, I think gave you the exact, but they either lost 40 or 50% of their book within months. So you deliberately put them into competition to start it out, but you don't have to even keep that up, frankly. Because pretty quickly, the rating agencies realize, you know, you have to remember, the rating agencies, apologies in advance if you work there or have close family, are not the place where the top grads go. So these are the people that always were pissed off that they were working, and making $120,000, and Fred, their classmate, was making $650,000 one year out. You know, like 2 years out. And suddenly, being in a rating agency, you could actually make money. And again, what was the marginal driver on this? It became, I think, something like 40% of total revenues.
Right.
Some big number, really big number, right? You can, you folks, I hope, will have a more exact. They made a fortune. And so I call it don't ask, don't tell. Because you could not look. I mean, to say that this had never been through a cycle, this is all nonsense. Liar's loans had existed. Adverse selection we've known about for certainly hundreds, maybe 1,000 years. What it does. Mari had written stuff saying that, you know, this stuff fully warrants, it calls it an open invitation to fraud. It says when we look, we find 90% fraud. 50% where they inflate their income by more than 50%, or 50% or more. Mm-hmm. Right? Just extraordinary margins. Same thing, Fitch finally looks. November 2007, non-random, no more money to lose if we look. And, you know, that's the one, the results were disconcerting. There was the appearance of fraud in nearly every file we examined. Remember, this is not doing investigative work. This is no detective stuff. This is frauds evident on the face of the loan file and the servicing file. Now that's, and they explicitly say, they being Fitch, they explicitly say that if you'd done any reasonable underwriting, this would have not happened. You would have spotted these things. Because that's, of course, in essence what Fitch did. It simply did underwriting on the basis of the cold record. And that's going to understate the actual fraud, right? From anybody who's actually kind of clever and fudge things better. But, I mean, when you're talking about how can you understate nearly every file of this fraudulent? So, had you been able to keep it for the secondary market, it's quite true that the mortgage bankers would have done what they'd done in prior ones. Remember, SNL started switching to become mortgage bankers when we cracked down on them in 1990-1991. They don't come back into the industry until the 2000s, mm-hmm. right? With the, not even deregulation, but really de-supervision of the industry. Most of the rules stay in place. But it's Chainsaw Gillerin, it's Daryl Doko returned to power. So, you weren't going to keep it out of the secondary market. Because it was going to get blessed. It was going to be blessed by the auditors. And how many ones have you found before late 2006 that got negative audit opinions?
I don't know if we found any.
Yeah. No, I mean, just think of that.
Right.
I mean, these are places that while their risk is exploding, well, the FBI is warning that there's an epidemic of fraud. They take their loss reserves to essentially zero in any real sense, economic sense, right? And they're not looking at loan quality because whenever they look at loan quality, everybody finds not little problems, but massive problems.
Well, let me ask you, because there, you know, I've seen a lot of what you're talking about, but let me give you sort of the counter-argument that we hear from folks and see in some of the financials, even the non-public financials backing up the public filings. And yeah, you know, you see the Alt-A, the payment option arm, the Alt-A, the liar loans, you see all of that. And yeah, there could be a lot of lying and fraud on the application about what the income is. And but going forward, really until you get into late 2006 probably, simply because home prices are continuing to appreciate, that even with the liar loan with the negative AM, you know, when the rate after 18 months, when the rate jumps, they can deal with it because they can refi or they can sell. So you can see why, one, you don't see rising delinquencies until you get into the later time periods. You don't see increased loss reserves. In fact, the SEC may crack down on them for playing the cookie jar game if they book more reserves. And because they are able to refi or sell the property, you don't see the delinquencies, you don't see the loan loss allowances going up, and you see the huge earnings, you see the huge revenues, you see the huge salaries and bonuses. And then, yeah, when home price appreciation stops and everybody realizes that collateral-based underwriting, to put it kindly, if just lack of underwriting altogether, then the music stops and the prices come down and the folks can't refi. And because you had this longer term in span of years, and so that we had a bigger bubble both in terms of number of loans and dollar amount of loans, and because of the originate-to-distribute model and a lot of this just getting thrown out to a bunch of other folks that actually didn't originate it, you don't see it blow up until really, you know, the fall of 07 when the first liquidity crises come and all of that. But, and I guess what I'm getting to is, you know, you say the primary reason is fraud, and I guess I want to take you to task a little on that. Is it fraud, or is it just lousy underwriting that was collateral-based that eventually caught up with folks when home prices stopped appreciating?
Okay. So that isn't a contrary argument. That is the argument I've just gone through as to why you would right-shift the demand curve and be able to refinance. That's precisely the mechanism. Right? And it was used before, consistently, in the savings and loan debacle as well. That's, after all, what Akerlof and Romer wrote their piece about this area of fraud. That was one of their examples that they used. And they explicitly say in the 1993 article that this extended the bubble. Right? So that isn't a contrary argument. That's precisely what we're saying. But here, you have to deal with the neoclassical approach is fraud has to be exceptional, right? It can't be significant, right? So, well, let's look at it. Savings and loan debacle, National Commission to look into it, right? What does that National Commission say? And this, I'm not quoting myself, this is Pierce. Says, at the typical large failure, fraud was invariably present. Okay? And in fact, it was. Look at Enron WorldCom era. They were all frauds. You look at the FBI. Are they wrong that there's an epidemic of fraud? No. How do we know this? We look at many different ways, and you see the same answer. First, and to be a little different than what you said, actually delinquencies are high relative to prime at an early point. In fact, are pretty much through the entire decade if you look carefully. And you're going to see EPDs, early period defaults, are as well. So a number of these things are blowing up even before they can be refinanced. But of course, and a variant of your point, and again, this goes back to a mechanism that we talk about, you know, longstanding. So you take it back and you're in a bubble and you sell it. You still don't have much of any loss, right? So there's, but tell me why an honest lender, honest secured lender, would inflate an appraisal.
Well, there's no reason an honest one would.
Right, exactly. And again, that's the point. This is how we taught people in terms of identifying, investigating, and prosecuting. So, did that happen very often? Inflating appraisals? Well, yeah, to the tune of millions of cases. literally millions of cases, given those numbers. Right? Is that enough to bring in people that cannot pay through adverse selection? Well, look at those fraud incidences that we find. Lowest we find is 50% with liar's loans, and it goes up to 100%. More in the 80% range-ish, right? Well, that comes back to my initial question. I don't know what the right number is because I know the people were misreporting. So I have the Credit Suisse thing that claims it's 50%. Strikes me as high. Say it's 30%. Take 30% of all new originations. Multiply times 80%. Mm-hmm. You're talking about millions of fraudulent loans. And again, I bring you back to, this is nothing new for a lender. We've known for centuries, literally for centuries, what it happens if we do deliberate adverse selection. Think of it another way. How hard is it to understand? Well, first, how hard is it to understand that if an industry calls it a liar's loan, there might be a problem with fraud?
Point taken.
And beyond that, how difficult is it to understand as a lender that if I put my people on volume commissions, my loan people and my underwriting people, I'll get disaster? That, again, every lender knows the answer. And again, look at things like New Century. Have you had a chance to look at the Examiner report?
I have not. I think folks here have. I have not.
Okay, so the New Century Examiner report quotes the New Century folks saying, you know, unless we actually put quality into our compensation system, the result will be farcical or continued farce, a phrase like that. If you want, I can pull it up on a computer and send it to you, the exact phrase. But again, WAMU does the same stuff. And in fact, you're going to see, if you look, and this comes back to the lack of investigation by the agencies, that this is pervasive, that people were put on volume commissions, and indeed, volume commissions weighted, if anything, by yield.
Right.
And it isn't just their internal people, it's what they purchased and how they incented the loan brokers, which is how most of them did this stuff. And again, what do we all know about agency problems? Right? This is nothing new. This is very well understood stuff within the industry. Now, I think you do have an interesting point about the SEC. And we certainly have that problem that you talked about under international accounting standards. So we have the argument that we're facing in Iceland that it would have been unlawful to put essentially any reserves on, because they simply refinanced. They were pretty much all crony loans, self-financed, where you purchase capital in the big three Icelandic banks. Right? So, I don't care what the capital standard is, I'll meet it. I'll exceed it. I'll exceed it by 50%. Right? And I won't have any losses because I'll just refinance them all. So, I agree that, some of the things the SEC did on cookie jar are dangerous. But, you know, there were cookie jar abuses where people were playing games. Freddie Mac did cookie jar, and they were caught cookie jarring.
Right.
Fannie Mae did the opposite. Right. So they both took very dramatic interest rate risk. Freddie won, that took opposite bets. Freddie won, Fannie lost. So Freddie cookie jarred, and Fannie played games with hedge accounting so that it wouldn't recognize the loss, so that it could max out the bonuses. The SEC, the nearly toothless SEC of this decade, catches both of them, right? So, you know, we should give some credit to the SEC. As bad as they were better than Ofeo. Right? And this gives, and the SEC complaint, by the way, explicitly says, I've looked at the Freddie Mac complaint, I haven't seen the Fannie Mae one, but the Freddie Mac one explicitly says that the reason Freddie Mac did this was to max its bonuses.
Right.
Right? Now that gives Ofeo, finally, the leverage to do something. And Ofeo, well, to back up one sec, to be able to do their, the way that Fannie and Freddie were both trying to max out their bonuses was by deliberately taking substantial amounts of interest rate risk. Right? And this goes back to the beginning of the decade. And to do that, they had to grow very substantially in portfolio. Because, of course, if you just trade MBS, the interest rate risk gets transferred. So they deliberately held very large amounts. And they'd even do really stupid things like go through the expense of creating the MBS and then buy it themselves. Right? Once the SEC cracks down, Ofeo has some leverage, and Ofeo orders restrictions on growth and orders them to clean up the accounting. Fannie Mae takes something like 2 years to be able to create conforming GAAP statements. That's how screwed up Fannie Mae was. It had to get a special exemption from the NYSE not to be delisted because it couldn't do conforming GAAP statements. But they, of course, didn't, they being Ofeo, didn't deal with the compensation system. Crazed, utterly crazed. So I can't grow rapidly. I still got these huge bonuses, but only if I have really extreme earnings reported. What am I going to do? Yield's the only thing left. And so they pile on the yield. And how do they do that? Well, some of it they do through subprime, but a lot of it they do from liar's loans. And remember, the liar's loans are not treating as liar's loans. They're treating them, or at least largely, they're treating them as supposed prime, the same way Lehman. And I bet you a whole bunch of other folks, I don't know what you've been finding, but I think prime was filled at a lot of the investment banks, so-called prime, with liar's loan, because they were sold under this bright, shining lie that they were really just like prime. Okay. Now let's,
basically, they come down to FICO scores. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, if the borrower had a FICO score above 620, regardless of everything else, it was considered prime.
Yeah, but no. This is worth a footnote. Okay, so how do they sell this insanity, right? They sell this insanity that, oh, these are folks that have non-traditional forms of income, and so they can't document. You're going, really? How about a tax return? We've got a whole form, as you know, as a lender, to have them fill out. And you know what? People don't tend to inflate their reported income on their income tax return. You know, this is nonsense. What they got, at best, was people trying to deceive their spouse and people trying to hide money from IRS. You want to select that for your borrowers? People engaged in defrauding loved ones? Wonder what they'll do to us as a creditor. Okay, so back to the plot. The One of the claims is that Fannie and Freddie did this because of their housing mission. It's so incredibly naive. They did it to get rich. Everybody knows it. God did it to get rich. And the top core could have cared less. And one of the proof of the pudding is the liar's loans. Because those aren't, many of them, of course, weren't to low-income people at all. They didn't get any credit for that under the rules. They did that for the same reason they did the subprime. And that was yield. Right? So, in an odd way, it's really the privatization of Fannie and Freddie, which was exemplified by their structure of compensation, that was the disaster. And it's bizarre. I mean, I was an expert for Ofeo in the case against Frank Rains, which they settled at a pittance, you know, just like they did at Freddie Mac. But after they settled, they said, hey, you know, we paid you this money, why don't you come out and brief us? So we did a two-hour briefing for the director and his deputy. Hour-and-a-half briefing for all the senior office types, office holder types, right, the leaders. And then a two-hour Q&A briefing for everybody in Ofeo. These people did not believe it was legitimate to regulate. Right? Ofeo was being run by George Bush's bestest buddy from high school. Right? People didn't love Ofeo. People at Ofeo didn't love Fannie and Freddie. In fact, they tended to hate them. Right? So this capture stuff, that's not what was going on. What was going on was they didn't feel that it was appropriate to regulate unless and until they'd established that it would produce a disaster not to do so. Well, by that time, it was a disaster. And so they did get conned completely on the liar's loans. I mean, Ofeo bought this insane story. And I mean, they bought it late. We're talking about 2006 and 2007 stated income loans were really just like prime. And of course the market was already blowing up. Right? You talked about delinquency rates. I think you'll find the delinquency rates are much higher on liar's loans than on prime all through the decade. And I think you'll find that by late 2006, they're already up to fatal levels. I mean, you know how thin the margins are. The rule of thumb typically was 5%. 5%, you're dead. Not 5%, you're crippled. 5%, you're dead. Right? So, how should I proceed?
Well, let me ask you some follow-up questions. So I hear you. And I hear you talking about the Credit Suisse report saying that 50% of originations were stated income. And assuming all your data is right on you know, let's say that 30-50% of all originations are stated income and a certain percentage of that are fraudulent. And they contribute to the bubble, and they contribute to all of these institutions blowing up in 07 and 08. I guess what I want to try to get at better is pick your brain on the sources of nailing down the percentage of stated income / liar loans that were actually fraudulent. Or are you just assuming that they all are?
No. I'm saying that we've looked, we being not me, mm-hmm. in the following cases that I know about. And, you know, add to it whatever you found. Fitch looked at a small sample. which I quoted them, you know,
right.
nearly every file.
That wasn't a random sample, though.
It's not a random sample.
Yeah, they adversely selected sample. In terms of they were looking for the ones that were most likely to have bad loans in them.
They were certainly looking at, in their view, risky loans. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you're quite right, it's not a random sample. Mari did essentially a random study in which it got the IRS forms that I talked about on 100. That's the one where they found, I believe, I mean, I quote it, but it's, I think it's 90% of the applications inflate income, and I believe it's 50% inflated by 50% or more. Aurora looked, and you can see in my Lehman testimony the exact number as to the percentage they found, and I'm not sure about it, but I believe it's in the 70-80% range. It's my best memory, but you can look it up and get it, or you can ask me to put it together.
When you say your Lehman testimony, Bill, were you interviewed by Valukas or in the actual litigation?
No, in front of the House.
Oh, okay.
I was testifying on the same panel with Dick Fuld, 6 feet from him. It was interesting. You can hear the acting chairman trying to gavel me down for 2 minutes. You look at the opening statement. WAMU. This is the Senate investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And there were at least two audits by internal personnel. And they find, I think, 50 and 85 or something like that, incidents of fraud. And again, these are all going to be just on the basis of file reviews, which is going to understate to some extent
mm-hmm.
the actual amount. Of fraud, of course. I can tell you there's also a small one, again, not random in criminology, where they went out and interviewed the loan brokers. And all of them said, we were just doing a service. Right? We knew what the numbers needed to be. There's an investigation by, I believe it's the Wisconsin AG. There's, as I said, the Cuomo investigation on the appraisal front that focused on WAMU, but Cuomo claimed that this was typical as opposed to an unusual case at WAMU. You can talk to him about his basis for that. I'm sure he's not busy campaigning. So, and you folks did the Citicorp guy about the percentage non-conforming with their reps and warranties.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay. Which started at 60 and after his warnings went up to 80.
Right.
If I recall the testimony there. So, again, what we have is a tremendous failure to investigate. Right? Think back to the savings and loan days, what we would have done. With these, we would have found out. We would have looked at samples of these loans, and we would have found out fraud incidents. Now, if that has not been done, that tells you the most important thing of any of this discussion. Right? Because that's the first thing we would have done. And again, that's exactly... Back in the savings and loan, my informal title as litigation director was chief coroner. Because we autopsied the failures to learn what was happening, to look for patterns so that we could identify things early before the disaster had struck. And there were really distinct patterns that make that optimize these kinds of frauds, like appraisal fraud, which makes no sense, again, for an honest lender. And we would look for those markers in the examination process. And we would prioritize places like that. And if you cut off refis, well, I mean, that's, you know, when people talk about Vernon Savings having 96% of its loans in default, that's after we cut off the refis.
Right.
Hey, none of them had any problem before then. Vernon deliberately refined it and made its loans extremely short-term. It's commercial loans, 6 months in length, so it could charge new fees to itself, all self-funded.
Right.
All of this stuff, in essence, is self-funded, you understand?
Of course, right.
There's no down payment. And you'll see also, particularly as they come to the end, you're going to see more end-stage plays. And that's in particular when you're going to see, hey, the bubble's slowing. We're going to have an utter explosion of near-term defaults. So let's go to neg-am, usually. And you see in that last 18 months or so, the percentage of that pick-a-pay and stuff is going to surge.
Right.
And that's why it's going to surge. I mean, the story is coherent in terms of observed events. It has a very strong empirical. Frankly, most of the other stories are adjectives.
Right.
Or they're symptoms. It's quite true that leverage was high, albeit probably about roughly half of Europe.
Right.
Leverage.
Right.
And it's quite true that leverage magnifies losses or gains. Everybody knows that. That's why they do it.
So what about, let me shift gears on some other areas and ask you about them, some on the statute, some on just what we've been seeing here. You've touched, of course, leverage and growth and fraud are all things we've been looking at. Let's switch to the other side of the balance sheet. One of the things we've seen, at least with the investment banks, and frankly, to a certain degree, even the commercial banks, since they, after Graham Leach Bliley, they started to do investment banking, but a very large amount of short-term funding. And a lot of overnight funding, billions of dollars of repos, commercial paper, et cetera. And one of the things we've seen is that when, you know, the music slowed and then stopped, and home price appreciation slowed and then stopped, and these loans blew up after they could only neg-am for so long, and the securitizations poorly performed, you know, that tended to spark the liquidity crisis, which was a much bigger deal for these institutions that instead of being 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 billion dollar institutions were trillion dollar institutions with hundreds of billions of dollars of repos, commercial paper, and other overnight type funds. Can you give any views on that part of it? Do you see it as a cause? Do you see it as just something that, not really a cause, but made the impact of the crisis much worse, or accelerated the demise of some of these institutions, or what?
No, this is something I look at a lot. And again, this is very much rises out of the Enron stuff. It's very similar to some of those things. I would, though, emphasize the liquidity crisis, and again, I testified on Lehman, so I looked at that bankruptcy report in some detail and such. The liquidity crisis is because of asset quality. It's not the other way around. And it has wonderful quotations in it from other major banks saying that Lehman had massively inflated numbers, asset values.
Right.
And calling it toxic and calling it crap and all, you know, the usual things investment bankers say, you know, their language and such. So that's why Lehman got in liquidity trouble. because it had a whole bunch of bad assets. And eventually what happens is, and this happened in many different places, many different times, many different places in the world, not just in the United States, is bankers stop trusting other bankers' asset valuations. And as soon as that happens, markets seize up. And there were real good reasons not to trust, because you were looking at your balance sheet and what your models had these things in for, and going, what if they're doing the same thing? And losses weren't, and here's key, and where it comes back again to fraud. If you lose 3% on a deal, well, you know, that's bad, but these are really big players. But when you can lose 80% on a CDO, and you don't get 80% losses without lending, you know, this kind of losses, when we're talking about $1 trillion stuff on liar's loans without massive fraud. So, now, yes, absolutely, the sieves did everything, right? So if you, it's like getting somebody, it's like the saying about Charlie Keating, right? That if you took him to Las Vegas, he would bet on every single game, and then he'd wager on the games, you know, with the waitress in the hallways type of thing. The sieves didn't just take enormous credit risk. They deliberately took enormous interest rate risk, and therefore they took tremendous liquidity risk. Now, why do you do that? You're doing it mostly because that's where you're hiding the leverage. You don't want to consolidate it. Now, what would have happened if you had to honestly value those assets?
You'd be insolvent.
Yeah, that's right. And then that would have flowed through, right? So the sieves are engaged in very widespread accounting fraud. And this is, again, what we try to get across. Really large-scale asset fraud valuations must flow through to accounting fraud, because the alternative is saying, hi, I'm insolvent. Any losses, $1 trillion. Real bad. You can't acknowledge it. And they didn't. Lehman didn't. And people ultimately didn't believe Lehman. And they refused to give it credit. They tried. They went to a lot of folks. They tried to pledge things. And people looked. And you'll notice that there were a number of attempts to sell places. That as soon as people did due diligence, they went away screaming, or they only bought it with incredibly favorable federal terms.
Right.
On who would bear the losses, or at least the bulk of the losses. So as soon as the people did due diligence throughout this crisis, Bear, Lehman, other places, they ran away screaming. Or they should have in the case of Merrill.
Right, right. Yeah. I don't know if B of A is too happy with that acquisition.
B of A is a very strange place.
Comment, if you can, on, again, going back to your liar loans, and really broader than that, all the non-traditional mortgage loans. You know, I get your story to the extent that all these loans that are being originated, and coming from the perspective of the originators, to the extent they're just moving them out. They're part of an originate-to-distribute model, and they're just selling them off to the GSEs or to the street. But these guys actually portfolioed a fair amount in the early days, and then, of course, when you get into 07, they're portfolioing a fair amount because they have no choice, because they can't sell it. But really on the latter, I mean, how does your theory comport with them keeping the stuff on the books?
Oh, it has great yield. What does adverse selection mean? The place is doomed. The question is, how much are you going to take out before then? And the answer is really extraordinary amounts. These people ended up far wealthier than they could have conceived of when they were 25 years old. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And they want to talk about these phantom losses, which are always the stock from its peak value.
But right, right.
The peak value was produced by accounting fraud, by overvaluing assets. And again, New Century is very good on this. New Century gets back report every quarter saying the loan quality is disaster. And they go, yeah, but we're selling it. So again, you have to have a story very different than the neoclassical story. Now, I don't have a problem with that. I don't, in fact, believe that markets are necessarily efficient, or that contracts are necessarily efficient. But you have to have a really perverse situation. And so, if you want to think of how bad things become, the genius of a market system is that voluntary transactions really do typically make both parties better off. And that's a really good thing. I mean, a really, really, really good thing. Right? And nobody has to tell them to do it. You know, Hayek has a lot of things right in this sense. Here, for massive amounts, we're talking about millions of mortgages, both principals were made worse off. The borrower, because he was or she was brought in to a house they couldn't pay for in the most overvalued portion of the market. And the lender, for the reasons we've talked about, right? That's the bankruptcy, looting bankruptcy for profit. They're the ones that go bankrupt. Now the agents make out like bandits by causing both principals to suffer injury. This is reverse Pareto optimality, right? Where both principles are made worse off. And we did that not just a few times. We did that millions of times. So this is the greatest destruction of working class wealth, and there wasn't a whole lot of working class wealth since the Great Depression. So, this is not stuff that's, we should be doing this to help poor people. This hurts. I mean, poor people usually couldn't buy anyway. That had to be fraud, right?
Mm-hmm.
For an actual poor person to buy a $300,000 home. So we're mostly talking about working class folks, although I'm sure you get the same thing I do. Everywhere I go, story about the hairdresser who made $40,000 a year with a $600,000 house. And it happened.
Right.
Now, there were also speculators. And you can see certain marketplaces. And, real estate is lumpy. This is not a truly national market. And you can see that, I don't know how much of your time is spent looking at commercial real estate, but this is not happening just in residential. It's just the commercial is very, very, very lumpy. So Atlanta's a disaster. But you can look, and it's the insanity of merit examination at the FDIC. This examination light stuff, mm-hmm. where they ignored concentrations that were just beyond the pale that we would have in our day. Shut them down today. What are these people doing? So, that's not as much the big guys, but that's causing you know, pick your version of a milder phrase for financial holocaust among a slice of banks that's knocking hundreds of banks out. So, you know, that happened as well. And it's much the same thing there in terms of the accounting.
Let me ask you about a couple of sections in our statute and see what you think about those as potential contributors to the crisis. Two things that I at least think of together are you know, the fact that there are pretty low interest rates, monetary policy throughout the 2000s, and then the inflow of money into the U.S. Do you see that as any kind of a contributor to the crisis, sort of providing the necessary capital to get it all done?
The second one, if it has any meaning, is through the first. So it's really the same. I mean, it can be a different input to why we have low rates. You can blame it on the Fed, or you can blame it on global imbalances, right? That's the magic phrase. Yes, no?
No, I follow you, but I guess, you know, other things we've heard from folks is saying, you know, look, you've got... you know, Europe and China and other countries, you know, taking their surpluses from their trade with the U.S. and coming to the U.S. searching for yield. And since rates are, one, that contributes to low rates. Two, since rates are low and they're looking for yield, but they're looking for safety and what could be safer than United States real estate. And that, you know, contributed to the demand for liar loans, subprime loans, and securitizations backed by those kinds of loans. Any comment on any of that?
Yeah. So, a couple of things. First, let's look what was being said then. So then, this was the greatest thing possible. Right? The standard neoclassical answer was lower interest rates mean the hurdle rate for productive investment is reduced. If the hurdle rate for productive investment is reduced, if other countries want to subsidize our capital formation, then we will have more productive investments and we will have superior economic growth. And we should be so lucky. Right? Similarly, by the way, and people forget this, Easterbrook and Fischel, you know, the biggies in corporate law and economics, they did an ode to extreme leverage. They said extreme leverage, you know, it's like the old joke about the prospect of being hung in a fortnight concentrates the mind mightily. And they said it is a guarantee against fraud. Because either you make a lot of money right from the beginning and consistently so you can meet the interest carry, or you go out of business really quickly and you can't harm people very much. So the standard neoclassical answer was that the environment we were in, high debt, low interest rate, was the best of all possible worlds. So it's in many cases the same people. It's like they forgot what they wrote. But I haven't forgotten what they wrote. Now, as you know, a lot of the savings loan debacle happened during periods of very high interest rates. Mm-hmm. So in fact, you don't need a low interest rate environment to produce a very large crisis. What was different then? What was different then was the secondary market. There was no private secondary market,
then,
essentially.
Then being what? The
back in the state.
Yeah.
Right? I'm sorry, was, am I talking over somebody?
I was clarifying to make the connection, but I understand now. Sorry for the interruption.
That was a little fuzzy. I didn't...
We're okay. We're good.
Okay. So, back in the day, the savings loan was a very different environment in the sense that you only had Fannie and Freddie. And Fannie and Freddie created the, I mean, people forget this, they created the concept, actually Fannie created the concept of prime. And they did it by going around, looking at best practices, and creating a very tough bar for it. And so you could not sell the toxic stuff, period. Because there was no private label of any meaningful amount, and Fannie and Freddie wouldn't buy it. So the savings and loan stuff was inherently contained in the sense of it was going to be kept in portfolio. Now, you can get a really good crisis going, right? It was widely described at that era as the worst scandal in financial scandal in U.S. history. But $150 billion is a lot different than pick your number in terms of the losses of GDP and such and wealth formation. So it is true that if you don't have a secondary market, losses will not grow as much. Of course, if you have regulators, losses will not grow as much either.
But what about that, Bill? I mean, we've actually, you know, a lot of the regulators say we're looking at the safety and soundness of the institution. What the hell do we care about the stuff they're selling off? I mean, that's my words, obviously, not theirs. But I do see regulators looking much closer at the stuff, and I've heard them tell me, look, we're looking at the on-balance sheet stuff. And in terms of the servicing portfolio, I mean, yeah, we're looking to see if there's recourse. But, you know, in terms of the asset quality, that's not our as much of our concern, if any of their concern, because it's off book.
Well, but that if they say they were looking at the recourse, then they would have not, you know, then they would have looked at the recourse and they didn't. Because the truth is, you know, it's interesting in terms of this reform bill. Oh, we're going to make you have, you know, a stake in it. Well, in truth, overwhelmingly these things had recourse. And indeed, overwhelmingly they had recourse not limited to 10%. And you can see, for example, in the New Century, that they were constantly fighting the battle on recourse. Mm-hmm. Because their kickback ratio was always much higher than what they were aiming for example. So, and you're starting to see it now, of course, because Fannie and Freddie are starting to do a little bit of the kickback. Can you imagine what will happen if they kick back to Citi?
Yeah.
$100 billion plus?
Yeah, or B of A now.
Or B of A, exactly, type of thing. So, no, I don't think that story works. And I don't think the story works because overwhelmingly this stuff was sold with recourse. And overwhelmingly, when you're talking about the liar's loans, that meant that quality was critically important to the survival of the entity. And no, they didn't look, because that comes back to my earlier question, Chris. If you find that the FDIC, the Fed, OTS did not look at samples of the liar's loans, can't give you good information on percentages of fraud, then you know that it didn't happen.
Right.
They didn't, in fact, look at recourse. That's just their story. That's embarrassment. That's not reality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me ask you about a couple more topics, if I can. Some of these we've touched on. Accounting practices, and in particular, mark-to-market accounting. You know, that we've heard from some folks that mark-to-market accounting, particularly when you got into the fall of 07 and then into 08, had a, an impact in terms of causing, you know, you got into this vicious cycle, right? I mean, once, because they were not market prices, they were fire sale prices, and that meant particularly the investment banks that are pretty much an entire mark-to-market book,
were marking assets to fire sale prices, which was depleting their capital, which was contributing to the liquidity crises, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You giving any credence to the mark-to-market accounting rules being a cause of the crisis?
I think that one's exactly the opposite of what they're claiming. I think that suspending the requirement to recognize other than temporary impairments has been a disaster that has greatly extended the crisis, and that one of the absolute best things that was done out of the savings and loan crisis was to require the recognition of losses, to sell the bad assets, to put failed institutions into receivership and sell them back into the private sector promptly. And it ain't just me, because every Treasury Secretary of both parties said exactly what I said and went over to Tokyo and said, what you're doing in covering up the losses through accounting gimmickry is going to and is already causing you to have the, as they were going through the lost decade, which is, of course, now becoming two lost decades, and today isn't looking much better for Japan if you looked at today's paper on the yen. So that, but the thing you're talking about, I think, is almost completely adjectives. Because first, I don't think these folks marked them down to market. And I don't think they can show you that they did. And the reason I don't is because they would have been massively insolvent. Second, they sold and valued this wonderful toxic stuff under the claim that this was readily marketable. And they purported to give that accounting treatment to readily marketable securities for years when it was in their favor. And they could use their model to create inflated values, which made their bonuses.
Right.
And suddenly, when it went the other way, it wasn't a real value. Now, by my calendar, it is roughly 4 years after housing prices stalled. And it is roughly 4 years after the first, the mortgage bankers, and then the savings and loans started dying at the rate of about 3 a week. I don't see this as a temporary impairment or a liquidity problem. And this comes back to, these are bad assets, and that is one of the reasons they will not look at them. This is one of the reasons the stress tests made sure that they never looked at the underlying. Again, how do you value a CDO? You have to look at a sample of the underlying. And that appears to have been essentially never done, as far as we can tell. Right, this is the S&P memo. Can I go berserk at the idea of looking at the underlying? It's the fact that Fitch doesn't look at the underlying till November 2007. And again, have them come in and show you that they looked at the underlying, what they found on the liar's loans, on the CDOs backed by the liar's loans. Now, what we do know is that some of the packagers hired typically outside groups. And, again, that needs to be, if you don't look, you don't find. But the stuff on the web certainly is filled with people who claim to have done that and have been pressured and all that there type of thing. I don't know. Right? That needs an investigation to be able to find out whether that's true or not. But they certainly didn't find, right? Because we can look objectively at the kickback rates. And we can look even at a place like New Century, which, as I said, the kickback rates were above everything they targeted, but they were 8%. But then look at the rates of actual early payment defaults in their, the stuff they have to keep in portfolio at the end, because it's the same stuff. And look at how big the losses were at a place like IndyMac. So you know that the securitizers were not finding through any underwriting process the reality of those. And frankly, they didn't want to. Because you couldn't sell it. It couldn't. You know, that's how you made your money. Selling it or putting it in portfolio at a high yield. But what happens if I have to put a loss reserve on to my high yield? What are these? Are these net assets or net liabilities? They're net liabilities. That's what adverse selection means. It sounds like an asset. Goes on my book, it says an asset. It's really a net liability. I really lose money. That's what adverse selection means. Negative expected value of the transaction. Every loan they made on, you know, it's a statistical statement, made them poorer.
Let me ask you about the GSEs. We, you know, it's one of the things we have looked at, and two, the statute tells us to look at. But, you know, let me tell you a couple of things we've seen and ask you to comment. Obviously, they were together, you know, represented, I think, close to $5 trillion of mortgages, which was close to, I think, half of the outstanding mortgages in the U.S. And we have and continue to try to look at the composition of their book, both on balance sheet and off balance sheet, going as far back as we can, and then coming forward, and have very good data on like 05 forward, you know, not so great data before 05, but a couple of things. You know, one, we saw them lose a lot of market share in the 03, 04, 05, even part of 05 time period, and then gain market share back. This is in terms of originations. And part of that appeared to be because they jumped into more non-traditional mortgage product in the late 05 and then 06 time frame. But then two other things. One, you know, I haven't at least been able to go back and sort of see the composition of originations going back. I'd like to, you know, go back to at least 2000 and see how much of the non-traditional mortgage product they were responsible for in terms of buying, in terms of originations, and perhaps creating demand, you know, and explaining some of the reason this product was being originated in the first place. And then, two, something we talked about a little earlier is the why of the GSEs taking on more non-traditional mortgage product, whether it's in the mid-2000s perhaps being to reverse market share declines, whether it's the, you know, the age-old story of making money. And then three, the affordable housing goals, which are an issue that a lot of folks, you know, point at as a particular reason for the GSEs taking on these riskier loans, and particularly in beginning in 2005, because November of 04 is when HUD increases the goal requirements and they go above 50%, and there's all these sub-goals too. So any comment on that?
Right. Well, first, to join in your caveat, are the numbers right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So the numbers seem to show that they lost a lot of market share, and that this corresponds with what we think we know from looking at the investment bankers. And even entities like IndyMac that may have created their own CDO-ish type products and such. So this seems to be private label leads the charge. And again, this is one of the major differences from the savings and loan days, that you have this private label availability. That definitely changes, or, you know, again, this is assuming the numbers aren't a big lie earlier.
Right.
And that Fannie and Freddie weren't actually doing tons of liar's loans from the beginning and just lying through their teeth about that. The response, as far as I can tell, and again, I did look at this in the context of the action against Frank Raines, had nothing to do with the housing goals. It had everything to do with the bonus and getting squashed in terms of portfolio growth. And that restriction on portfolio growth became caused by the SEC catching them and Ofeo finally feeling it had enough leverage to restrict their growth. So, again, if you got the same compensation, and the compensation appears to essentially stay the same, even after the enforcement actions, you can't make the numbers anymore through rapid growth of portfolio. You can't run the interest rate risk game. And, of course, they're now looking at the interest rate risk as well, so it's not a good place to run the game. So what's left is you've got to hyper-concentrate on yield. They can only do mortgage-ish type product. What has really high yield? Liar's loans and subprime. And again, the fact that they do so many liar's loans, assuming, again, that the facts prove that out, as far as you know, do the facts show that they become a very high percentage purchaser of liar's loans, not just subprime?
Well, I don't think I can limit it to liar's loans from what
I'm not saying too limited.
Right. But what I've seen in terms of 05, 06, 07 is, one, you see them buying a lot more subprime private label securities.
Right.
And two, yes, you see them, you know, in terms of the risk layers, they are buying a lot more non-traditional mortgage product than they were before. And the risk layers get layered on top of each other, and you know, it's not a pretty sight.
Right. Well, what I'm coming from is, did you know Dave Felt?
I don't think so.
Okay, Dave was one of my litigation attorneys at the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who then worked for years for Ofeo. The way he tells it is the Fannie and Freddie emphasized the stated income, and that it was, after all, essentially prime, back to our earlier discussion.
Right.
And that Ofeo bought this. Now, again, this makes you want to throw chairs through windows type of thing. But he was a moderately senior type within Ofeo and conversant with these things. So that's his story about it. I can tell you that I had comments in about credit risk in my expert statement, and they had me take them out because they brought no charge, they being Ofeo, brought no charges based on the imprudent credit risk. Only the interest rate risk. So Ofeo appears to have been utterly blind to the credit risk being taken on. And as I say, not a single person we talked to, the top two guys for 2 hours, and then an hour and a half or so for every office head and his deputy. So that's about 20-ish people or something like that. And then the whole staff. Not anyone. And this is, we were talking 3 months before the collapse. Right? Not a single one, even in the most closed door session, raised any concern about credit risk.
Wow.
Can I ask you, are you saying you're skeptical of that? Are you saying you're skeptical? I want to clarify what you're saying. You're skeptical that an enormous group of people like that could be so blind. Are you saying that?
I'm sorry, you're garbled on this end.
Are you saying that this group of people collectively could have conceivably been so blind, or are you expressing skepticism?
No, unfortunately, I'm saying that that's exactly how they appeared. I don't think that there was some grand conspiracy to keep this from us. It was fairly, it was, you know, wide-ranging discussion, no ground rules, et cetera, et cetera. This simply, you know, the usual cliche, wasn't even on their radar screen. Now, does that make no sense at all to anybody with analytical abilities? Yeah, but, you know, look at OTS, IndyMac, WAMU, Countrywide. These are all things that you would have, these were all easy. These were not hard as a regulator, right? As I said, we killed these things in 1990, 1991. We didn't think we were especially bright for doing so. They were obvious, right? These were things that everybody knew. Everybody'd seen the movie. Everybody knew how it had to end. So, Ofeo, what I was trying to say is the difference is the liar's loans in general wouldn't have given them credit under those housing goals. At least large amounts of them wouldn't have given them any credit at all, because they would have been, especially with the inflated incomes, above the cutoff dollar amounts. So you need an explanation for why they did not just subprime, but also so many of the liar's loans that wouldn't have qualified for housing credit. And to me, the explanation that makes sense, and having seen them and studied them, the explanation that makes complete sense is this place was bonus driven, absolutely. This place being Fannie and Freddie.
Right.
Were both driven utterly in their senior management, and not just senior management. The, you know what the scariest thing? Look at my statement about their internal auditor. Right, so the internal auditor is supposed to be, you know, take your cliche about Caesar's wife,
right,
type of thing. They're the ones who are supposed to stay pure, even if everybody else goes bad. And if you've seen the movie Patton, you have to sort of think of the opening speech by Patton with a massive American flag. This is Rajapaz, chief of internal audit's speech to his troops. And my point is, this is the opposite of the canary, right? The canary is more susceptible. This is supposed to be the least susceptible. If internal audit had gone this bad, you can imagine what the rest of Fannie was like. It's scary stuff. You'll read it and just cringe.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Raines saw the speech. He sent a copy of it to Raines, and Raines made some technical comments essentially praising him.
Okay, let me ask you, I mean, I'm fortunate for you, I'm looking through this statute, and we've touched just about on everything, but let me... I think there's one, at least one thing I need to ask you about that we haven't really talked about, and that is derivatives. Do you think what role do you think derivatives played, if any, as a cause of the financial crisis?
Okay, so I testified on this to the Senate, Senate Ag of all things, because of course that's historically where derivatives largely started. They, by the way, were focused almost entirely on credit default swaps. I had to remind them that CDOs were a derivative. CDOs were enormous for the reasons we've gone through. That if you don't have a secondary market, you don't get as big a disaster. Because you can think of it like a wildfire that will burn out earlier as it consumes the stock available in whatever industry. So that was certainly very, very important. And the fact that it was a CDO does, and again, I'll give you a little criminology, is, but also regulator, and that is the deliberate creation of complexity is one of the great signs of fraud and, of course, hiding things, simply whether or not it's fraud or not. And that the CDOs were really wonderful in that sense. Because it's all pretty much sleight of hand. How can you start with toxic and end up with AAA? And in particular, how can you do that when 80% was first tranche? Mm-hmm. Right? Now, anybody could create we could all create a top tranche that had only 3% of the cash flow, right? You only needed 3% of the cash flows. Then it would really be AAA.
Right.
But you can't make 80%. Right? Especially not, of course, with these kinds of fraud incidents. And again, when you're doing liar's loans, it makes it all the more critical to review the underlying. And that's what the rating agencies deliberately didn't do, because the whole thing would have blown up. They could not look, because if they did, they would document disaster in the underlying. And that's not just in 2006 to 2007. That's much earlier. Mm-hmm. So CDO's huge part. CDS, interesting. AIG's big enough all by itself, and the markets were sufficiently roiled that it's a big deal. And they were worried because AIG had such a big book of business. They were scared to death. They were shocked at the breaking of the buck. When I say they, I mean Treasury and the Fed. They absolutely freaked. They didn't anticipate those kind of knock-on effects. And, you know, like every hour there was some new market somewhere in the world that was shutting down. So this is when they really did believe that they stepped on not just a mine, but a nuclear mine. Or however President Bush pronounced that. With AIG, because it was such a huge player in so many different markets, and because reinsurance is such a big deal, they were also worried. But the bigger thing was, because of the Commodities Future Modernization Act, they simply didn't know anything virtually about this market. They didn't know who the counterparties were. They didn't know what the exposures were. And they were just petrified that it was going to blow up some next, not just necessarily one Lehman, but maybe 7, 8 Lehmans, and maybe 4 different places in the world. So back to that opaqueness, you just cannot regulate effectively when you have no data. Right? And markets start freaking as well. It's interesting, they can go along for years with opaqueness. But there's no crisis, so yeah. But when something happens, they start focusing on, oh, what's my exposure? And then they can't answer that. And then suddenly the world is a very scarier place. And so there's an enormous behavioral economics aspect, a behavioral finance aspect to all of this. So credit default swaps, AIG, as I say, is big enough that it's significant. They thought it could be hypercritical. Probably they were wrong on that, but I don't know, because again, those positions were secret or proprietary. It's not skull and crossbone type stuff, but it was all proprietary. It was all confidential. So going down the road, credit default swaps are ultra scary. And a clearinghouse, if you want, you can see my testimony. You can see the very conservative economists agree with me that a clearinghouse would not have prevented this crisis, because the valuations would have been wrong, completely wrong. And not by a little bit. The valuations are far blanche, if the Yiddish means anything. So this isn't just loss. This is, you know, you try to drive home tonight and 24 hours later you realize all the signs are in Spanish. That's far blanche.
What about, I mean, understanding your views on CDS and AIG, you know, some other folks we've talked to, you know, on certain sides have said, look, CDS are actually very good in terms of credit indicators to the market about what's going on with companies. Other folks have said, you know, naked CDS is just an absolute problem. Other folks have said CDS may have, you know, contributed to or extended the housing bubble and the origination of non-traditional mortgage loans and the securitization of these loans, whether it's RMBS or CDOs, because folks could buy CDS protection against them and therefore were less vigilant on looking at the underlying credit quality of the actual asset because they had originally a AAA and then a AA trillion-dollar insurance company insuring them, or they had an AMBAC or an MBIA, you know, providing protection on them. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, and it's good to link that to MBIA and AMBAC because these are essentially the same story, and that is there's nothing like promising insurance you can't pay. And that was the game, right? So all three of these entities made promises they couldn't possibly keep if things went bad, really bad. And all of them assumed either that they couldn't go really bad or that they would make a lot of money and that it would be an Akerlof and Romer story, right? Mm-hmm. That they'd walk away personally quite rich even if AMBAC went down. This is very common again in other spheres. Right? Fraudulent entities will try to mimic really good firms by offering superb guarantees. And indeed, if just a few people call them on them, they'll quickly give you your money back to shut you up, which is why it's always worthwhile to call.
Right.
But they can't possibly pay for the really bad quality. So that is a problem. This is stuff that's often called insurance. It is most assuredly not insurance. And I urge you not to use that phrase in your report. Right? It could not meet the requirements for insurance. And it is true that there are serious dangers if you don't have an insurable interest. There are reasons we restrict insurance to insurable interests. And it is assuredly true that the fact that I can bet, you can bet, a zillion of us can bet the same way on the transaction, that's back to my fallacy of composition. That's when you can get enormous breakdowns in markets. And so we've been very lucky, I think, that the stars haven't aligned in a way to blow up much bigger things. Now, you asked as well, can these things provide useful market information? And the answer is yes. If you lie about the accounting, which we've changed the rules so that you can lie about the accounting, then having a credit default swap that's trading at X is an indication of valuations. That's pretty far from a first best solution. So I'm not real enamored of that as an explanation for why you'd want these things. Did the role of AIG spur some of the CDO sales? Probably is the answer. And again, our problem is maybe you have information, but we don't have good information on how they were used and reliable data because it was all proprietary. So is there a logical chain? Yes. Would that logical chain have increased CDO prices? Yes. Right? Because you could get a guarantee. Now, note that that's not a liquidity problem. That's a mispriced guarantee that never should have been sold. And standard microeconomics, when you misprice things like that, you're going to misallocate resources. And you're going to harm productivity, and potentially you're going to worsen bubbles and all those nasty type of things as well. But I can't make that. While I can say that I can explain a logical mechanism, makes sense, but I don't have the numbers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know of other people that have the numbers. I hope you folks may have gotten some of them, so you can get some idea of how much this induced. But you see, they created whatever they needed because it creates a market opportunity. Right? Again, if you think of Hayek, spontaneous order in economics, as soon as you create a profit opportunity, there is at least the chance that someone will fill that niche. Hayek assumed that would be good people. Criminologists say, yes, but also bad people. Well, because these, you provide a useful service when you provide a ephemeral guarantee that can't really be called upon. And AIGs couldn't really be called upon without the taxpayers of the United States of America. In the end, that's going to be true with AMBAC and MBIA. But also, it's the old joke we tell in banking all the time, Chris. You know, and that is, if the bank loans you $10,000, the bank owns you. The bank loaned you 10, in the old days, million. Now we'd have to make it billion. You own them. What happens if you got claims against MBIA for three times their capital? Are you going to assert a claim for 60% of their capital? Because then you'll have to recognize, before they gimmick the accounting rules, at least you would have had to recognize an impaired credit.
Right.
So there's actually safety and weakness. It's a really perverse world once you get into it, but it's not an illogical perverse world.
Right. Do you guys have anything?
I have a few questions. We talked a bit about the GSEs. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
And the profit orientation. Now, you mentioned that the GSEs were not involved in the S&L crisis, even though Fannie was a publicly traded corporation since 1968. And my sense from reading stuff is that people didn't really become concerned about this profit orientation until the early 90s. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that gap, I guess.
Yeah. Executive compensation changes enormously in this era. And it, again, there are very good links in, now empirically in terms of financial restatements and fraud and such. If you have compensation tied to primarily to short-term income, because of course that's the easiest thing to gimmick. Mm-hmm.
And that sort of leads me into my next question about market discipline. There are several things that we haven't talked about in terms of who could discipline these companies. One is the investors in some of these instruments. I mean, the banks kept a lot of it, but they still managed to sell some. Another is the equity holders in these businesses, you know, people, someone who holds Citi stock. And a third is the labor market. This is Jamie Dimon's statement, well, you know, if I mess up, I lose my reputation. So therefore, you know, I think you remember that statement.
Yeah.
A fourth is restricted stock. This was a reform that was intended to address this very idea of short-term incentives. So I realize I've given you a lot, but could you?
Well, let me add a fifth.
Okay.
This is the biggest one in banking theory and in practice, uh-huh. And that was subordinated debt.
Yeah. Well, that, the too big to fail problem seems to, or you have a different opinion.
No, subordinated debt is supposed to even deal with that problem, right? So the theory of subordinated debt is, first, it can only be held by financially sophisticated folks,
right.
Which is, first part of ideal for private market discipline. And the second thing is you can only buy it along with that, therefore you can only buy it in large dollar amounts, and because it's subordinated, you'll be wiped out, right? And for example, in the savings and loan crisis, we always wiped out sub-debt holders. It's supposed to be risk capital, and so we did that, and that's supposed to create, of course, all the right incentive structures and such. However, in the savings and loan crisis, in the Enron WorldCom, and in the current era crisis, and I go around giving this talk to lots of industry types of, all different ideological persuasions, nobody has ever been able to point to a sub-debt holder actually exercising effective market discipline, or frankly even trying to exercise it. So it's one of those areas where it's a perfectly logical theory. It's been structured, it was created, it was accentuated in the Basel process for the precise purpose of doing this. Regulators encouraged institutions to issue sub-debt under this theory that it would add to discipline. It just doesn't work, and it doesn't work because of what we try to get across. That four-part recipe that I said, right? Mm-hmm. Ultra-fast growth, et cetera, that produces, the phrase that Akerlof and Romer use is, it's a sure thing. It's a mathematical guarantee that in the short term, if you do those four things, you report not just profits, but record profits. But if you look at those four, you'll also see that it is an absolute guarantee of producing real losses. But creditors aren't able to distinguish well the real versus fictional profits, is what empirically we find out. So they see a huge profit. And what happens? Well, any of us have been in banking. Bankers are busting down your doors trying to lend you money in those circumstances, right?
Yes.
So that's the reality as to why that form of discipline doesn't work. And that's supposed to actually be the strongest of the four that you talked about, right? Restricted stock. Well, that is part of it, but they get very large bonuses beyond that, and you can keep this going if you would hyperinflate the bubble for a lot of years. So, and you can, sometimes you can get them to reprice and all kinds of other types of things as well. And so that one hasn't, in fact, it's further misaligned the interests of shareholders. That doesn't seem to do it. Skin in the game, just the general concept of skin in the game, was that one of the five that you gave or four?
No, but I assume that restricted stock was supposed to, provide some skin in the game.
But you see, it doesn't, because it's not my own money,
right.
Really, and it gets its value from the inflation from my record reported earnings. And such. So that one doesn't, they don't understand how much of a sure thing and how it's, you don't just report kind of nice profits. you report really extraordinary profits. So stockholders don't exercise discipline. What happens when you report great earnings is the stock appreciates.
Right. Is there any information that they don't have that if they had, they would be able to discipline better?
Yes, certainly. I mean, if you had real analytics, people saying, hello, we've seen this story before. By the way, this is negative expected value. This will crash and burn. But why would you allow it in a banking context?
Okay.
Right? Hello, this is going to end in disaster, but until it does, we're just going to sit on the sidelines type of thing. So, but you're right in a different type of way. If you have effective regulation, you simply have much better information, much more reliable information, and that does help investors, and that helps creditors exercise more effective discipline. The real thing that if regulation works, what you really want it to do is to stop the perverse Gresham's dynamic. You don't want cheaters to prosper. If cheaters prosper, you know, then the phrase again, then this Akerlof used in his 1970 article on lemons,
right.
You know, is that the folks with the bad ethics will drive the folks with the good ethics potentially out of the marketplace. Not forever necessarily, and not everywhere, but, you know, all too often. So there is a win-win, but the FDIC hired, is it Susie Orman, right? Isn't she the, you know, the credit-ish type?
The sort of online pundit sort of thing? Or not
yeah.
Online, television, yeah.
Yeah, so they hired her. Yeah, and of course, there is good standard neoclassical economics that says consumers are in the best position to make better choices. It is unambiguous that if you offer more choices, they'll be better off because only people for whom those choices are superior will make the choice. No one will be hurt. Some people will be benefited. And then, but maybe some people would make bad choices because they lack information, so let's give them Susie Orman. Well, as I said, we have, pick your number, 5 to 10 million people who were made massively worse off in terms of being underwater on their houses. And we have bank after bank or lending institution after lending institution, they were all banks, blown up. So the standard sort of neoclassical consumer choice literature and grand welfare maximization, not so good.
Right.
In this context. And but you're right, if you get rid of the people who are sending the bad price signals, then that's another way of looking at it. And again, Akerlof and Romer explicitly talk about this in their 1993 article, that the frauds distort the pricing mechanism. And that's what a bubble in essence
right.
does. So yeah, we can improve private decision making, effective limited regulation. Right, but you try to do some really basic things like, no, that always ends in disaster, can actually help the private sector a great deal. That part is true.
Can I follow on that question, Professor? This is Alexis Simmendinger, and I'm part of the writing team, and I want to ask you a question about the report itself. You've given such a passionate case here for 2 hours about the failure of regulation, and we have most of America sort of standing around in the wreckage trying to figure out if anything has changed. Do you have any sense, after describing what happened going forward, that this report should give anyone who reads it any hope that anything has changed?
Well, you know, of course I write about the limited change that the new administration largely left in charge. That it inherited, that left in charge the OFAO people, left in charge the OTS folks, although some of them resigned on their own. But, you know, the ones in charge were a big part of the problem and such. Now OTS is gone, sort of gone, or merged into it. So if you're looking, it would be the CFTC director seems to be trying to get a handle on things, and the SEC enforcement director is generally well respected. The SEC chair, not so much. But that's, I mean, part of it is simply leadership. You can really transform. All of these places are not that big in truth, if you compare them to big businesses. So if you put in good regulatory leaders, you can transform them pretty quickly. If your question is, how do we survive for 30 years? Well, nothing's going to work all the time. But that doesn't mean you can't try to institutionalize a very professional culture. And as bad as the FDIC is in the modern era, it's still better than any of the others. And it is still better because of that institutionalized culture that put greater emphasis on the examiner. And this is one where I think Chris can be very helpful to you in getting a sense of this. There are places where you come up through the ranks and you really have to know something to be considered a real regulator. And so even when they put political folks in, they tend to pick up some of that culture that they really ought to learn. And that helps. You can think of institutional structures. So the FDIC is generally considered, and I think this is true by academics, to be more conservative simply because it has the insurance function. And it has to cut the checks. It has to put the places into receivership. That tends to create a different mindset. So I think having the FDIC as a backup examiner and regulator is a very good idea. And one of the terrible things that happened is that its sister agencies deliberately attempted for this last decade to keep the FDIC out of their institutions, what they call their institutions. Even though, of course, in a sense, since it's the insurance fund, they're all there, the FDIC's institution. So I would strengthen that FDIC backup rule. I think that the Fed is terrible as a regulator for institutional reasons. Again, apologies to all the Fed folks there, some of whom I even know. But the Fed has never had supervision as more than a tertiary priority. At the Fed, real men, and it was men, did monetary policy. Macroeconomic stuff. And it turns out it's also a culture dominated overwhelmingly by economists. Now, I teach economics, but I think it's a really bad background for most regulators to have.
That cheered the room up immensely.
We didn't get to the labor market reputation issues. We have Daniel Mudd. Fannie Mae blows up. Now he's CEO of Fortress Investment Group. Are they looking to run a control fraud?
Here's what I would say that people miss. Concern for reputation can cut in both directions. So we distinguish between opportunistic and reactive frauds. Opportunistic probably makes sense. Reactive is you're in trouble. This is more like the classic moral hazard. The standard neoclassical analysis is that, and this is why we needed supposedly very different executive compensation, was that CEOs find it very difficult to diversify. They have most of their wealth, most of their income, and their reputation invested in a single place. That shareholders, because it's relatively easy for us to diversify, would prefer greater risk. You know the standard type stuff from the neoclassical thing. But reputation, therefore, concern for maintaining reputation can lead to you engaging in a cover-up. And a cover-up of losses, another word for that is accounting fraud. And if you're publicly traded, Rule SX makes that securities fraud as long as it's material. And the only reason to cover it up is because it's material, so you know it's typically material as well. So that's one problem, the reactive. In behavioral economics, we find that people fear falling more than they anticipate gaining. Losing 100 is worse than the opposite side of the transaction. And that brings us to opportunistic. So the many folks aren't geniuses, but they can get guaranteed record profits if they run the scam. And what do? Then they make political contributions, they make charitable contributions, they're on the front page in the modern era. You know, to be a top CEO with record profits, you're on the covers, you're to the fancy balls, you're on the first name basis with the president, he has a nickname for you.
Right. But the question is more from Fortress's perspective. Why do you hire a CEO who has just come from a failed institution?
Well, why do you hire them when they come from two failed institutions, or failed or failing? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking of, didn't he end up with GM and getting forced out of GM?
GE.
Cerebus. I mean, he had come from a disaster at Home Depot.
I thought he was,
we're not talking Mudd anymore.
I'm talking about a different guy, but the guy.
Talking about Immelt?
What?
Immelt?
Mudd came from General Electric.
I'm not talking about Mudd. I'm talking about the guy that ran Home Depot.
Right.
Was a disaster there. Then he went to Cerebus running, wasn't it GM? Wasn't it Cerebus that
Chrysler.
Was the GM? Then he was a disaster there. And I'm sure he's hired as well. I mean, Alan Greenspan got everything wrong. Anyway, they made him chairman of the Fed. The Shell got everything wrong, and they made him dean of the UChicago Law School.
But why?
The CEO reason is a bit different, I think. The CEO is, there aren't that many people that have run vast places, and they're afraid of putting people in who haven't run really, really vast places. Because that is a very different managerial task. I think that's their excuse for how they truncate their searches. In the political realm, unfortunately, people actually get chosen because they're willing to give the wrong answer. That's a very valuable thing to some senior people.
Sure.
I just wonder if there were any cautionary tales along the way that people should have looked at. I mean, what you're saying is there was green light after green light that led to this thing. What about, for instance, LTCM? Didn't that suggest to people that these executives, these managers who might have gotten away with something, that maybe there was more to lose than to gain?
You're asking about LTCM?
Long-term capital management.
LTCM is. But I'm missing perhaps the nature of your question about LTCM.
I'm wondering about cautionary tales that might have been in the path leading up. What I'm doing is I'm writing about the period leading up to the crisis, and I'm kind of wondering, you know, listening to you, there was one signal after another. You can get away with this even under the worst of circumstances. Weren't there any counter indicators that maybe might have made someone think, maybe I won't get away with this?
Well, LTCM, the principles suffered no, I mean, it was, you know, maybe it was a little embarrassing, but all of them ended up with high level employment, including was Meriwether, right?
Yeah,
I mean, Meriwether just went to the next big thing. I mean, LTCM is certainly a cautionary tale and we haven't talked about this as much, but there's a major problem. This is not black swans, and this is not perfect storm. Neither of those explanations really has much to do with anything in this crisis. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that there aren't fat tails. There are, in fact, fat tails. And it is true that the models typically assumed a normal distribution. And what that tells you, back to your cautionary tale point, is people don't make the equivalent of third grade errors like that by mistake. If you assume a normal distribution, all of the factors being held constant, you increased the value of the asset, the reported value of your model and asset model. Period. And you do it by a substantial amount because the tails are, some studies suggest, five times as big as a normal distribution. I mean, this is not a trivial thing. Now, everybody knows they're not normally distributed. And these people that do the models are really, really, really bright. So when they pick a normal distribution, they do it for a reason. Their bonus is bigger if the values are bigger. Right? Similarly, they truncate the VAR. Well, it's unambiguous that if you truncate the VAR, the reported asset value will be greater. Right? I mean, so again, there's a reason people truncate the VAR, and they did that. But the broader problem is there is no distribution. Right? All of this assumes that there's some external world out there. And there's an exogenous distribution. Right. In fact, we make the distributions by our incentive structures. It's endogenous.
So what
now,
do you say?
Are there exogenous elements? Of course.
So, Bill, let me ask you something, because one of the things is, as I'm sure you will not be surprised, you know, many of the senior executives that we've, or at least I've talked to, and I assume that others here have talked to, who presided over companies that either died or came real close to it, you know, have sort of made this argument of, look, you know, we had good risk management and we had fine capital and liquidity, but we never modeled for a 30 to 35% decline in housing prices. That had never occurred since the Great Depression. And yes, I will even concede to you, FCIC person CFER, that, you know, we realized that a lot of the loan product that was being originated in the decade of the 2000s was new kind of loan product without a history, you know, and so we were uncertain about what was going to happen with those, because prior to the 2000s we didn't have a lot of these kind of loans, and we certainly didn't have a lot, if any, excuse me, of these structured type securities. But, you know, we built our models and we tried to do our best, but, you know, if housing prices would have gone down 5 or 10%, we would have been fine. Housing prices going down 25, 30, 35%, we're not fine.
Yeah.
You know, so I want your comment on that, on saying, look, it's not our fault. It's that there was a decline in housing prices that nobody ever foresaw.
Okay. We have to vacate this room.
Okay.
We can carry this on, if you like, and I'm of course very interested in this topic. I gave a talk to the quants, but I need to get off now.